From Luke's Gospel, from Luke 6, as we continue our series of disciples, be one, make one.
One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and his disciples began to pick some ears of corn, rub them in their hands, and eat the grain. Some of the Pharisees asked, Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? Jesus answered them, Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then Jesus said to them, The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, Get up and stand in front of everyone. So he got up and stood there. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it? He looked round at them all and then said to the man, Stretch out your hand. He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus.
We've all come across those people. We've probably all at times been those kind of people. The self-professed expert who knows all the rules, can give you chapter and verse of how things are supposed to be. Perhaps it's someone who gives the impression that if they were the England rugby, football or cricket coach, then our national team would never lose another match. Possibly easier to be the rugby coach at the moment than the cricket coach. Or possibly it's someone like me who knows exactly how each ballroom or Latin dance should be danced and will be vindicated when Craig Revel Horwood or one of the Strictly judges agrees with me when they give their verdict on the dance which has just taken place. In the last couple of years, I've known many people who claim to be Brexit experts who, if they were in charge, would have fixed the deal long ago, though I'm not sure if any of them exist anymore. And throughout Luke's Gospel, we come across the experts who Jesus was contending with. Last week, we were focusing on the call of the disciples, and so we didn't read the story which sits between the calling of the fishermen and the calling of Levi. But it tells of the healing of a paralytic man. And Luke records that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were there, drawn to Jesus like moths to a flame, anxious to hear what this latest preacher was saying and doing. It seems their radar is on high alert right from the beginning. Is this man Jesus operating within the law? So if we look back to Luke 5, one day Jesus was teaching and Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting there. They'd come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem, and the power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal those who were ill. Some men came carrying a paralyzed man on a mat and tried to take him into the house to lay him before Jesus. When they could not find a way to do this because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and lowered him on his mat through the tiles into the middle of the crowd, right in front of Jesus. When Jesus saw their faith, he said, Friend, your sins are forgiven. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law began thinking to themselves, Who is this fellow who speaks blasphemy? Who can forgive sins but God alone? We often hear them mentioned, but who exactly were the Pharisees? Well, Tom Wright describes them like this. The Pharisees were an unofficial but powerful Jewish pressure group through most of the first centuries BC and AD. Largely lay-led, though including some priests, their aim was to purify Israel through intensified observation of the Jewish law, developing their own traditions about the precise meaning and application of Scripture, their own patterns of prayer and other devotion, and their own calculations of the national hope. Though not all legal experts were Pharisees, most Pharisees were thus legal experts. In our story that Nick has just read to us from Luke 6, the Pharisees are once again keeping an eye on Jesus and finding him wanting. This time, their issue is appropriate behavior on the Sabbath. For the Pharisees, the Sabbath was a key part of their Jewish identity, along with circumcision and their food laws. It was to be observed by not participating in work from sunset on Friday to sunset on Saturday. And they'd created a plethora of rules and regulations about what could or could not be done. And so we read in verse 2, some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" They'd observed some of Jesus' disciples plucking the grain, rubbing it in their hands, and then eating it. I'm guessing it might have been okay if they'd just been picking blackberries or some kind of fruit from the bushes, because that wouldn't have required work. But it seems it's the fact that they had to work the grain, rubbing it in their hands, which I'm sure is easier to do when it's new grain. But you do. You end up with grain that they could then eat as they walked along. But I think what the Pharisees were objecting to is the fact that they had to work the grain. They had to rub it in their hands to remove that outer layer. It seems that this is what made it work and therefore an unlawful act in the eyes of the Pharisees. And then we read of another Sabbath. This time the setting is the synagogue, the natural home, the place where the Pharisees just felt that they belonged. They knew how things should happen there. And the situation that we read about there feels as if it may have been contrived by those opposed to Jesus so they can catch him doing something unlawful. There's the conveniently placed disabled man whose right hand was withered. And I assume, like in many cultures in the Middle East or in Asia, the right hand was generally used for clean things such as eating, and the left hand for unclean activities such as toileting. Pity those like me who are left-handed, but hey, that's the way the world was and the way the world is still in some countries. It would have been seen by many as a punishment from God to have a withered hand, to have a disability, perhaps a mark that your parents were sinful people. And when Jesus encourages the man to stretch out his hand, and he was able to, the Pharisees, instead of rejoicing, were filled with fury and began to discuss together what they could do to Jesus. The Pharisees are so focused on holiness and purity, on keeping their particular interpretation of that law, that it seems they've lost sight of the original intent of the law. So let's take a moment to think about Sabbath and its origins. It takes us right back to the creation narrative where God creates the world in 6 days. At the end of each day, God recognizes that what has been created is good. And then on the 7th day, when the work is done, it says God rests. We read in Genesis 2:2-3. By the 7th day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. So on the 7th day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the 7th day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, I'm genuinely not interested in whether you believe in a literal 7-day creation or evolution or something in between. This creation account is pointing us to some profound truths about the rhythms of creation and rest which God has ordained. We often don't stop to think much about that notion that the all-powerful, omnipotent God who has just created the universe out of nothing takes time to rest from the work of producing and makes the seventh day holy. A day of rest is a holy thing. But the creation narrative is not the sole reason behind the principle of Sabbath. When Moses receives the Ten Commandments, including the injunction to keep the Sabbath, it's clear that it's to be a regular reminder of both creation, but also of the Exodus. If we go to Deuteronomy 5, we read this. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Why was the Sabbath such a reminder of the Exodus? It's because when they were slaves in Egypt, they had to work all day, every day, making bricks. When they requested time off for worship, to celebrate a festival, it was not only refused, but their work was made harder. We see in Exodus 5, that same day Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people. You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy, that's why they're crying out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies. The Israelites knew what it was to be in slavery, to have no control over what they did, to be forced into this endless production of bricks. And God had given them freedom of that by rescuing them. The Sabbath was a reminder that they're now free to worship God and to rest from their labors. And it seems very sad that the Pharisees had taken something which spoke of freedom and rest and strangled it with regulation and petty observance. They had utterly lost the true sense of what Sabbath was supposed to bring. And we'll think a bit later about how and why Jesus takes issue with their interpretation. But before we do that, I want us to pause for a moment and think about what we have done to the principle of Sabbath. Now, sometimes, particularly during particular periods of church history, Christians have also taken a very Pharisaical approach to Sabbath, with strict laws about what could be done on Sundays. And sometimes, and some of you may have memories of some of this from your childhood, or perhaps from your parents' childhood, a sense that anything which was fun or enjoyable could not possibly have a place on the Sabbath day. But it feels as if the pendulum of opinion has now swung away from such restrictive practices to the world in which we now live, where life never stops and Sundays are almost indistinguishable from any other day of the week. We're very good at saying that Jesus did not come to do away with the law, but to fulfill it. And most of us would say we try to keep the Ten Commandments, but do we? Whether we're talking about Saturday, the traditional day for Jewish Sabbath, or Sunday, the day Christians celebrate Jesus' resurrection, how many of us take seriously the command to take a day to rest, a day to do life differently? Walter Brueggemann, famous Old Testament theologian, In his book, Disruptive Grace, argues that most of us have, perhaps unwittingly or possibly intentionally, returned to living in Egypt. We live and work in a 24/7 culture where even if we're not at work all the time, work can often find us via our smartphones or computers. We value and applaud productivity. Even our children are the subject of academic targets, where as soon as it looks like they'll reach their target grade, the grades are raised so that many children, when doing exams, can only ever reach their targets or fail. There's no possibility of them exceeding them. It has distinct echoes of life in Egypt, where the more bricks the Israelites made, the more they're expected to make. We may speak as people who say we'd like to be less busy, but we often actually wear our busyness as a badge of honour. In our culture, it shows our worth and value. And if we're not careful, we even begin to believe the lie that our workplace, our homes, this church cannot survive without us. We look dangerously like people who share Pharaoh's anxiety that production must continue, that there is no time for rest. We must be making good use of every minute, of every hour, of every day. People whose whole identity is tied up in what we do and what we achieve. But that is not God's way. It dishonors God and it does us no good. Brueggemann says this: Sabbath is a refusal to participate in the anxiety system of Pharaoh. It is the dramatic insistence that there is life outside the production-consumption system. Human persons, along with the Creator, can trust that the world will work without constant attentiveness. Yahweh's life-giving system is a sharp and complete contrast to Pharaoh's brick-making system, in which everyone is propelled by production anxiety. It is a radical either-or. When Moses says to Pharaoh, "Let my people go that they may worship me," the intent is to choose the rest system of Yahweh over the anxiety system of Pharaoh. We live in a culture where anxiety becomes more and more prevalent. Perhaps we need to stop and ask if we have chosen the wrong kind of systems to be part of. So what is Jesus' attitude to Sabbath? Perhaps to understand it, we need not only to look at how Jesus responds to the Pharisees' provocation, but also to look at the conversation which precedes this encounter towards the end of chapter 5. There it says this: They said to him, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." Jesus answered, "Can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days they will fast." He told them this parable: "No one tears a piece out of a new garment to patch an old one. Otherwise they will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins." Jesus is wanting his disciples to understand that his arrival heralds a new era. It's no longer the time for preparation. That was John's role, to prepare the way, to call people to repentance and fasting. But now, Jesus is here amongst them. Just as you don't patch an old garment with a piece of new cloth or put new wine into old wineskins, they need to recognize that Jesus has not come to put a fresh patch onto the old law. Instead, he's come to do something new. The bridegroom is here. Jesus has come to bring his kingdom into being. It's a time for celebration. This kingdom will bring God's values, God's intentions for his world into being. Jesus has come to show them the way to new life. Now, a very long time ago, I studied English literature as part of my Bachelor of Arts degree. Each week, I'd read the set text and feel I'd understood it, only to go to the tutorial and discover that there were apparently whole layers of literary criticism that I'd failed to grasp. I often used to wonder whether, if the author was present, they too might be as bemused as me by the various interpretations put on their work. And I've had that same experience in art galleries, so I could relate to this cartoon which I saw. If you see the guide, in this piece he feels an urge to communicate a moral and intellectual outrage towards war. And the artist at the back saying, I had no idea, I'm so good. Many artists take guided tours to get their work explained. It highlights how there can sometimes be a gap between what the author or artist actually created and the interpretations and the layers which are then put upon that. If you want to think about it another way, imagine you want to coach a football team. You might think that the best way to learn is to study some coaching manuals, making sure you're well-versed in every possible game strategy, details of the rules, etc. But imagine then if Sir Alex Ferguson turned up and started watching your team play, perhaps offering some opinions on how they might improve, what the best use of each player might be. You'd be crazy not to stop and listen. Alex Ferguson may not have created the game of football or written the rule book, but he's arguably one of the most successful managers of all time. His understanding of the game comes from a lifetime of firstly playing the game and then managing teams successfully. He knows the game at a deeper level than could ever be learnt about football from just studying some manuals. It's not the same, but I think it gives us an inkling of Jesus' experience as he interacts with the Pharisees. They have an interpretation of the law which they're keen to espouse and to persuade others to follow. But what they don't recognize is that Jesus brings an entirely different perspective because he is the author, the creator of the law. He knows not just what it says, but the original intent behind it. When the Pharisees complain about his disciples picking and eating grain on the Sabbath, he replies with a story about David and his men taking and eating the consecrated bread, which it was only lawful for the priests to eat. That incident in David's life, found in 1 Samuel 21, happens when David is fleeing from Saul. It's at a time when David had been anointed by Samuel as the next king of Israel, but he's yet to take the throne. He and his men are desperate for food as they hide out from Saul, and it's Yahweh who provides it by allowing them to eat the holy bread. Jesus, it seems, is trying to show the Pharisees that he too is the anointed one, the Messiah, the King who they've been awaiting. Jesus and his disciples, just like David and his men, will be provided for by God. This is a time for feasting, not fasting, for celebrating that the King is among them. The Sabbath is important and holy and special as a reminder of God's goodness and God's life-giving provision in both small and big ways. In providing grain in the fields which can be eaten and in healing the withered hand of the man in the synagogue. Sabbath was never intended to be life-denying or burdensome. The author of creation, the King, who is healer and life-giver, is present with them in the world. But the Pharisees can't see it because they're so caught up in their desire to live holy lives and to make sure that everyone else does too. Is it their self-righteousness which blinds them to who Jesus is? The Sabbath is good news for those who will receive it and embrace what Jesus is doing. So what is the good news for us in these stories about Sabbath practices? We know that God doesn't want us to be legalistic keepers of the law as the Pharisees were. They were angry with Jesus for not complying with their strict ways. They saw shame in Jesus' desire to eat with tax collectors and sinners. They complained when Jesus did good things such as healing people or turning people's lives around just because it happened on the Sabbath. But Jesus came to bring grace and freedom. We saw last week as we looked at the first disciples being called that the correct response to being with Jesus is awe and amazement. It may be that, like Peter, we won't feel holy enough to follow Jesus. Well, that's good, because Jesus, it turns out, is not in the business of calling holy people who think they have all the answers. We don't see him recruiting Pharisees or the teachers of the law as his disciples. He calls those who know they are sinful and broken. Just as the practice of Sabbath shows a different way of being from Pharaoh's way of anxious, never-resting production, so too Jesus shows that his kingdom is based on different values from those of the world. He reminds the Pharisees that Sabbath is there to do good and to bring life. In his kingdom, people's needs matter more than regulations. If you read on through this chapter, Jesus goes on to highlight how different life is under his reign. Love is the abiding value, not just for those who are like you, but for your enemies too. In God's kingdom, the last are first, the sick are prioritized, and there is time for rest and reflection and prayer. Following on from this incident, we hear that Jesus goes and spends the night in prayer as he seeks who God the Father is asking him to have as his disciples. Jesus prioritizes quiet time as well as times of action. People and their needs come ahead of productivity in Jesus' kingdom. So I think it's not surprising that Jesus chose fishermen as his disciples. We see from the story of their calling that they were used to spending nights doing nothing, waiting for the fish to bite. They know that not every hour could be productive. But many of us need to relearn that. We need to remember who we belong to. We don't want to be slaves of Pharaoh, finding our identity only in what we achieve. We are children of the King. God wants us to rejoice as we rediscover God's way of living. We need to embrace the life-giving nature of Sabbath to find ways to rest and be refreshed in God's presence. Now, it seems to me the hard thing about being a disciple and seeking to follow in Jesus' ways is that we find it all too easy to turn it from a relationship into a set of rules, just as the Pharisees did. That's where they'd gone wrong. So the church must be a place which shows people a different way. It cannot be right for our lives to look like a busier, more judgmental version of those who have no faith. The King has come. We need to embrace and live by his ways of love and grace, celebrating and valuing all that is life-giving. I want to confess that churches do not always speak that message loudly enough. We sometimes make people feel that church is a place for those who are well, who have it all sorted, who don't need help. I want to assure you that if you're here today feeling broken and in need of rest and refreshment, you're in the right place. Let me read to you some words that Anne Voskamp says in her book, The Broken Way. She says this: I was 18 with scars across my wrist when I heard a pastor tell a whole congregation that he had once lived next to a loony bin. I looked at the floor when everyone laughed, They didn't know how I'd left my mum behind the locked doors of psychiatric wards more than a few times. When they laughed, I felt the blood drain away from my face, and I wanted to stand up and howl, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick." Is there a grace that can bury the fear that your faith isn't big enough and your faults are too many? A grace that washes your dirty wounds and wounds the devil's lies? A grace that embraces you before you prove anything and after you've done everything wrong? A grace that holds you when everything is breaking down and falling apart, and whispers that everything is somehow breaking free and falling together? I had wanted someone to reach over to me at 18, sit in that church pew next to me, someone to touch my shoulder, to steady things and say, "Shame is a bully, but grace is a shield. You are safe here." What if the busted and broken hearts could feel there's a grace that holds us and calls us beloved and says we belong, and no brokenness ever has the power to break us away from being safe? What if we experience the miracle of grace that can touch all our wounds? I wanted to write it on walls and on the arms scarred with wounds, make it the refrain we sing in the face of the dark and broken places. No shame, no fear, no hiding. All's grace. It's always safe for the suffering here. You can struggle and you can wrestle and you can hurt, and we will be here. Grace will meet you here. Grace, perfect comfort, will always be served here. She paints a picture of what life in God's kingdom should be like. We pray that our church is that kind of place for each one of us. Because we find it so easy to listen to those bullying words of shame, which tell us that we can never do enough or be enough to be good enough for God. Instead, I want you to remind yourself that you live under the shield of grace. You are the beloved child of God, who wants you to know his love, his rest, his peace, his wholeness. These things are what Sabbath is all about. He wants those things for you because he's a good and loving father who knows what we need. He knows it's not good for us to be people who are endlessly trying to work, to do, to produce. We need, as God shows us right back at the beginning of creation, we need to be people who take time to rest, who can celebrate the freedom and the grace that we know in God. May we be together a community where God's love is so in evidence that others are drawn to it. If we continue to read on in chapter 6, Jesus describes more about what his kingdom looks like. He says this: "Do not judge others and you will not be judged. Do not condemn others or it will all come back against you. Forgive others and you will be forgiven." And we're going to think more about forgiveness in church together next week. But it goes on to say, "Give and you will receive. Your gift will return to you in full, pressed down, shaken together to make room for more, running over and pouring into your lap. The amount you give will determine the amount you get back." Jesus' kingdom is a kingdom of abundance, and God calls us to experience that abundant love and share it with all who we meet. So what is it that you need to hear from God today? We're going to spend a bit of time together in silence. The musicians are just going to come and play quietly for us, because I want to give you some time. You may be saying to me, "You don't know what my life's like. I can't take a whole day of rest." Well, what we can do is begin to put Sabbath moments into each and every day. to take time to pause, to be with God, to hear from Him, His love, His desire for us to know His abundance, His grace. Maybe you're feeling broken today. Perhaps God is asking you to let go of some of the unhelpful ways you have of being and instead just know yourself as His child. So I invite you to just spend a few moments as the musicians play. I'm just going to give you some time to be with God, talk to Him, listen to Him, enjoy a Sabbath moment of rest.